Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I am Leona Abraham Brando, host for Blog Talk Radio, Shedding Light. We've been honored to have on the show with us these past couple of weeks Thomas Dahmer. Thomas, who served 4 years in prison from the age of 19 to 23, is now 27 years old, and he has been discussing his downfall and the reason that he ended up in prison. Thomas, a young man who has educated all of us on the ineffectiveness of prisons for most of the population of incarcerated individuals who have made mistakes or mistakes in their lives. Thomas went into the prison at a young age. Prior to that, he had all kinds of dreams of becoming a professional soccer player. He was an EMT. He had so many things going for him. And unfortunately, because of a relationship that failed and there was cheating involved, he went downhill and ended up becoming an offender. Thomas had childhood goals to become a professional soccer player until later in years he made that one mistake that ruined his dreams, at least for 4 years. Thomas has since been released, and he has gone full force once again pursuing these goals. Before we begin, however, I would like to have Thomas talk about some of the things that he has experienced throughout these years. I also want to bring up the fact that there is so much going on in the world today, especially in this country, with mass incarceration. We know that other prisoners in other prisons in other countries do not have mass incarceration. We unfortunately have 2.5 million at least incarcerated in the penal system, whereas other countries have not had this. They have not had the mass incarcerations. They have not had the inappropriate rehabilitative programs. They have not had a lot of things that we have been blessed that we have gone through in these years. But one of the things is, and I will say this, especially with this epidemic that's been going around, this international epidemic, we have to be very aware of the dangers of having mass incarceration with prisoners congested in these prisons, these things that are going on. And unfortunately, the concerns that we have over bringing these infested conditions from outside into the prisons and then outside of the prisons to many of us in the populated areas of this country. So these are some of the things that they have been working on, many advocates and law firms as well, and politicians, in trying to reduce the prison system and trying to get rid of the population, the overcrowdedness of the penal system. So one of the things we want to make sure that we do is consider all these things and listening to these stories about the injustices in this country. So I believe we do have Thomas on with us now. Tom, are you on with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit about yourself again to let the people know, the population that we are addressing right now, to let them know what you went through and some of the concerns you have, even of today, of the penal system?
Well, my name is Tom Dahmer. I'm 27 years old. I moved to California a year ago to potentially live out my dream to be a professional soccer player. When I was younger, I went from having scholarships to serving 4 years in prison for an armed robbery with a BB gun. Just long story short, and I just never realized, I never talked to anybody, never had anybody in my family that went to prison, let alone jail. So it was all new to me, and I just, you know, I put my head down, I worked, and now I'm finally getting an opportunity. So there's a lot wrong with the penal system. You know, I have about 100 things on it, but I never realized, you know, at the time when they sentenced me, they just said 4 years. You know, people just think you do your 4 years and you come home, but I never really realized how much of a uphill battle it is, and basically how we're treated as inferior human beings for the majority of our life after that. So it's kind of like a death sentence going to prison. It's very hard to rebound from it. and to continue with the dreams and goals you had before it.
I was also mentioning just before you came on with this epidemic that's going on around the world, especially in this country right now, the concerns that many have about the overcrowdedness of the prison system with this epidemic. What are your thoughts on that, Tom?
They're definitely overcrowded. I remember when I was in, we had to share cells. You know, people were sleeping on boats and people were sleeping on the floors. It's just, you know, the system, I understand it's difficult to look at every case, you know, as its own, but you're judged on black and white. You know, you're just judged on a crime, and, you know, then there's about a average time that you do or you get sentenced for that crime, and they kind of keep that revolving door around. I just think they need to look into it just a little bit more. The judges and the DA really need to look into these crimes a little bit more to find out the people that don't really deserve to go to prison. Because there's a lot of crimes that, you know, you might think off just the top of your head of, oh, they need to go to prison. But, you know, they don't really realize the repercussions that does to that human being. They're stripping them. There's a lot of human beings in there that I understand doing 3 or 4 DUIs is not a good thing, is not a safe thing. You're putting other people in danger. But, you know, most of those people that never committed a crime in their entire life besides drive drunk, you know, 3 or 4 times, plus all the times they didn't get caught for, I don't really think it's the greatest idea just to throw them in prison cell for, you know, 2-3 years with killers and rapists. And some of them are hardened criminals, some of them are not. But it's just a really different environment. It's a different world with different mannerisms that not many compare to the real world. So I think they need to start looking at, you know, crimes like that, less violent crimes, you know, as far as marijuana. You know, that's the new trend of, you know, letting people go that had marijuana crimes and charges. So I understand the prison population is extremely overcrowded. I know that there was a program called the 11 by 15, and they were trying to minimize Wisconsin's prison system to 11,000 by 2015, and it's 2020. Wisconsin's prison system is almost 25,000. So that clearly didn't work, and it just continues to get more and more because of how the probation is structured. It's just crazy how different states in the United States are so different from each other as far as California and Wisconsin, as far as just, you know, smoking marijuana or doing things like that. You know, you can get there's still some states in the United States where if you get caught smoking marijuana, you're doing, you know, 25, 30, 35% of your revocation time. You know, and some people got 4, 5, 6 years, even longer of probation or extended supervision or parole. So I just think that there's a revolving door. And the biggest thing is the resources when you get out. You know, some states set you up with resources with schools that come there and job opportunities and things like that. In some states, you know, you just get out and you do everything on your own and you're just told, you know, not to go back to prison. So I definitely agree with the overcrowding. It's pretty nuts how many people they jam in a cell.
You mentioned, first of all, with the programs and everything, you mentioned the marijuana, you mentioned those that are in prison for drug-related alcohol or whatever. You mentioned programs when they come out. How do you feel? I mean, my feeling towards that is these programs that they offer when they come out should be offered prior to going in. So when they stop for DUIs or whatever these things, instead of putting them in prison, wouldn't you agree that it might be more beneficial to these people if they put them in these programs instead of putting them in prison?
I agree. Yes.
And I was also going to ask if you can also address and let the people know exactly what it's like in being in a cell, the size of the cell, things like that. And also you mentioned putting them into areas where there's more severe or violent offenders. Some of those things, if you can just address some of those issues, because I really think the audience would benefit from hearing all of that.
Yeah, no problem. I definitely agree about the programs. You know, it's 2020, so thankfully, you know, the prison population is starting to get a little bit of awareness. We've had a couple people go into prison with high statues, so, and that's kind of put a little bit of awareness on how broken the system is. You know, the programs can vary. You know, whenever you go to prison, it's just not going to prison. Anybody who's went to prison understands that there's a food chain just like everything else in the world. And, you know, there's certain crimes that are down at the bottom. There's certain crimes that are, you know, more up top. So, you know, these programs vary very drastically depending on what your crime is. So that's number one. As far as just talking about like DUIs or other, you know, really nonviolent crimes, there are a lot of programs out there where you can like put a human being in, give them a second chance, third chance, whatever you want to call it. But you know, you'll be able to find out if they're going to succeed or not throughout these programs. Some of them are like high intensity boot camps, and some of them are, you know, alternatives as far as like, ours is called, I can't remember what ours is called, but it's like a work release. It's Huber. Ours is called Huber in Wisconsin, where, you know, you just spend the night in there, but you go out to your regular work. You continue in the community. You continue, you know, taking drug tests, alcohol tests, make sure you're clean, and just kind of like, you know, do like that. And that's all paid by the person that's in there. So, you know, it's costing nobody money. I just think that that's a better alternative than sticking a person in a cell with a killer. My second cellmate ever, I mean, I got sentenced at the time, but I was in a maximum security prison waiting to go to my other prison. And they stuck me in a cell with a guy that was 23, and he was facing life in prison. He was in the middle of a jury trial, and he got found guilty. So it was like the second technically ever cellmate I was sitting there is, you know, he just got sentenced to, you know, life in prison. His mentality is way different at that time. You know, he's never going home. And I had 4 years, so it was kind of, and that was our staffing agency. So, you know, if anything, if I would have gotten a fight or if anything would have happened between us, I would have continued my bid in max. And I just think that alters, that doesn't give anybody a fair chance, you know what I mean? I know you can't stick everybody in a cell with crimes close to them or anything, but you can kind of see the difference between somebody having, you know, life never getting out and somebody having 3-4 years and couldn't go down to a minimum. So it's a completely different life and bid. And I just think about, you know, how small the cell was. It was very hard to get used to. You have bunk beds, not many cells are single cells unless the guys have been there for a long, long time and, you know, they're on the waiting list for a while. And they have a long time to go. But the cell is very small. It's just got two bunk beds. And by the time you jump out all the bunk bed to the other wall, it's only about a step, not even a full step. And then, you know, there's usually one dresser in there, you know, split up between two drawers. And then most cells either have like a bunk or boxes underneath the cell. And you can put your canteen in there. That's like, you know, food or hygiene. Whatever you have to kind of, you know, stay living in there. And that's about it. You know, there's a little cell. I was in a medium prison for most of the time, so we had a key to our cell. It always locked, but, you know, throughout the day we were able to leave our cell and, you know, walk in the yard. But I've jotted down every single cellmate I had for 4 years, and it definitely makes a difference how you live your life compared to the cellmate you get. So, you know, it can be a very hostile environment in the summertime when it's 100 degrees and, you know, you just have two people in a cell baking and you don't like each other. So it can be a different situation.
And some prisoners talk about the hygiene of another prisoner that might be in the cell, and you're dealing with the smell and you're dealing with a lot of the dirty environment. And there, I know that must be a problem too when someone goes into prison and they're basically a clean person and they're around that kind of environment. Sometimes I think of prisons as having, or the prison officials or guards having, it's like a gladiator. They enjoy watching the, you know, prisoners that are in disagreement. They enjoy watching, putting gangs together, you know, rival gang members together. And it's almost like an entertainment with them. And Right now, Tom, you're talking about all these things. You're really the voice for a lot of prisoners, and I mentioned this before. But some of these things, I'd like to get back to the rehabilitative programs versus incarceration, because the crime you committed, it was with a toy gun, and to me, it's something that could have been resolved without sending you to prison. It's something that could have been resolved by putting you in some kind of a program, like a pre-prison program or something like that, where people have an opportunity to change while not being behind bars getting worse. And some of these things, you know, I'd like to know what you think about all of this.
I totally agree. The only reason I can't speak that much on these programs because I don't really know many of them. I've never really seen many of them exist. Is the idea nice? For sure the idea is nice. Instead of, you know, because it costs money for you guys, you know, for the system to house people. So I think it's just more beneficial for everybody. It gives people second chances. It gives people an opportunity to change their life or do something with it, or, you know, to show them that those poor choices aren't, you know, their whole life. And if they fail in these programs, then, you know, then it's easier to send them to prison and it's easier to sentence them because they failed again. My programs that I'm specifically talking about, I like to talk about everything that has affected me and has, like, I've walked through personal, so I can personally, you know, talk about it. But like I said, I never had an alternative program offered to me. I never had, you know, because I had a Class C felony. So for Class A, B, and C felonies, you know, those are pretty violent and those are pretty serious felonies. So there's really not many programs for A, B, and C felonies. I know in the state of Wisconsin, there was a 180 juvenile diversion program, it was called, and I was a leader on that program, a mentor. And that's just for kids 17 to 24 that have, like, minor crimes, possession, and things like that. So it's not on their record. They don't have to serve 90 days in jail. And they pay a fee, and they go through 9 months of boot camp and stuff like that. So I think that's awesome to offer to the youth. I just think these programs that were offered to me when I got out, I feel like if they were offered to me when I was, you know, on sentencing or out on bail, they would have really, really helped me out. And that's just – there's certain schools out there that, at least in California, that have a reentry program, it's called. And that means if you've ever been, you know, system impacted or incarcerated, or any system impacted is kind of the most general term, you can, you know, you file for school for free, financial aid helps you, you have people on board that's been in the prison system that are, you know, continuing in schooling, so they get it, they understand you. You have counselors on deck that if you need somebody to talk to, and you just have resources and just basically an opportunity. You know, most of these guys or women that I've talked to, they don't want anything easy given to them. You know, for some reason, most of these people that are incarcerated and are from these negative backgrounds where it's like, you know, you would expect them to want to hand me out. They don't. They want to work hard for it. They don't want it just given to them. They want to get it, and they're willing to put in the hard work as long as, you know, the opportunity is there and it presents itself. So I just think more opportunities, and like I said, I'm just thankful that it's 2020 and there's certain organizations, there's certain people with influence that are finally speaking up and willing to donate and willing to look into the system impact of population and offer schooling, because that's what's changed my life is, you know, going to school is, you know, getting help with a job and just certain things like that where you can, you know, get back in the swing of life. Because once you go to prison, no matter what, it takes time. You need that chunk of time. You don't just come out of prison after doing years in it and, you know, the next day you're fine and you just are able to, you know, pull up your boots and go to work and able to live a normal life. It just takes time. It takes time to get reintegrated back into the community. It takes time to switch your mannerisms over from how you would react to a certain situation in prison to real life. And just the stress, you know, time goes by a lot faster out here. Time management is really hard because, you know, time just flies. And I just think if you're willing to offer people, you know, work support, transportation support, and just support, just people that, hey, man, we've been through it. We know what it's like. Here's a couple of resources. You know, we understand paying rent's hard and just getting up every day and showing up to work and just living a normal life, staying away from all those influences is pretty hard, because most people that don't go to prison, they don't have all these influences. They aren't from the hood. They aren't from, you know, where most of their best friends are doing something negative. And I understand that's not their fault, but that's the environment that most of these people grow up into, and they don't really realize it until they go to prison and they're sitting in a cell and they're like, whoa, you know, this isn't the quality of life that I want to live. I don't just want to be a jailbird. It's really not cool to be in jail. Everybody that's in prison and jail that has any type of value to bring to this world, they're not in there bragging about it. They're in there working hard. They're in there trying to change themselves and change anything about it to get out. They want to be free. They want an opportunity. That's all they want. So when I came to California, it was kind of cool to see that, you know, they offered their you know, system impacted, you know, at least just some opportunities where, you know, other states, like I said, you get out and applying for a job, that's all on you. Getting a house, that's all on you. And like, these are very daunting tasks when you get out to find a secure place to live, to have enough money to put a, you know, security down and the first month rent. And then also to prove, you know, your income that you can pay for this. This is like a very daunting task. And most of these guys don't have that or have a support system. So they go to these public housing and they go to all these other things. And now you're going from a prison cell to public housing. And you got to think about the influences that are there and the people that you're surrounding yourself with and the, you know, the situations that are arising in there. So I just think more support, more help, nothing given out, just an opportunity. Just get, you know, give people an opportunity to show that they're different. Even as far as, like you said, the programs before prison, they could have done a lot to me. You know, I was 18 at the time, and I was out on bail for a year. I volunteered 1,000 hours in a year. I had my whole community back me up. So they could have looked into things like that and, you know, kind of said, okay, you know, we can give a second chance. We can at least give him an opportunity to show that he's not, you know, a hardened criminal and things like that. And there's, like I said, there's a lot of ways, you know, as far as the jobs, you know, the one thing I've learned is churches, you know, there's a lot of churches that are willing to help. There's also a lot of churches that aren't willing to help, you know, don't get me wrong, but there's a lot of churches that are willing to help, where if you can get a job at a church and you know, you can report, you can have somebody check in and see that you're doing good. When I was out on bail, I had to show up to the courthouse, you know, every 2 weeks and do a UA, you know, that's a urine test to make sure I was not on any drugs or alcohol. And there's certain ways to kind of see if a person is, you know, kind of learned from their lesson and is back on the straight and narrow path, and they just need to keep adopting these ways and keep adopting these programs. I would love to start something for, you know, youth. There's nothing in the world really for youth that have violent crimes. You know, what about these 17-year-old kids that I understand they're first degree reckless endangerment, or they're getting caught with a pistol and they're having a weapons charge, but, you know, getting caught with the unregistered gun, like, you know, they're giving kids 3, 4, 5 years for that, you know, 17, 18-year-old kids, where, you know, it's a norm. You know, if you're not walking around in some of these projects and some of these neighborhoods where, you know, most of them you can't even be white, some of them you can't even be Latino, you can't even walk around with, you know, projects in Chicago and New York and things like this. They don't stand a chance. You know, they're kind of set up to go to prison, you know, because if you're not walking around with a gun, you ain't going to be walking around with nothing pretty soon. Your life's going to be taken from you. And that's just the way some of these environments are set up. So I just think there's got to be an alternative to at least give the younger population, the teenage kids, at least somewhat of an opportunity, somewhat of something to show that their life is valuable. And doesn't be, you know, it's not taken from them, because no matter what, when you send a teenage kid, which that's what they are as a kid, into prison, an adult prison, it's just, it's life-changing. Simple as that, it's life-changing. Whether it's good, whether it's bad, whether it's prolonged good, it's going to alter that kid's life for the rest of their life. Their whole life is going to be revolved around, you know, being in a prison cell. So I just think that there's got to be somewhat or someone to have some type of ideas and resources to come up to at least give these kids an opportunity to show the world that, you know what, this isn't them and that they can change it around.
And those resources are being used in the penal system, which to me is a waste of money, of taxpayers' money. And those programs that you're talking about, and you'd be a good one to start an organization, a nonprofit, to work with those type of youth, because you have so much insight into all of this. coming from Wisconsin, it's surprising too. Coming from Wisconsin, you seem to have insight into all of these things that happen in the ghetto, happen in the cities, in the inner cities. But the monies that are used for prisons are not being used properly. It's a waste of taxpayers' money. And if they were to, you know, start these facilities or start these nonprofit residential treatment programs around the country in all these different areas, as we mentioned before, anger management, in the, you know, youth mentorship, you know, in substance abuse treatment and mental health issues, these things would be so much beneficial to those that are in the prison now. And as you said, coming out of prison, they can't, it's not easy coming out into the communities, back into the system, the community. It, like you had family, you mentioned you had a lot of support, which is something not all prisoners have. So coming directly from prison into the communities may not be the appropriate way of doing things. But at the same time, if they had some kind of transitional period, transitional facilities to work with them from prison to transition into the communities would be good. Now, you, with all the experience you had in your young years, what would your recommendations be for, say, incarceration period or alternative treatment programs or facilities? What would your recommendation be to our government in the way they distribute the funding for programs?
Well, number one, I'm going to start with instead of adding on things that don't exist, and throwing a Hail Mary, I'm gonna start with something smaller, and that's the juvenile system. I think if it started with the juvenile system, I think we would see somewhat of an impact. The two biggest things I think that would help the recidivism rate, that one day that's my dreams and goals to do, is to implement different rules and different structure how the juvenile system has worked. Because if you look at the percentages of people going back to prison and re-enter, or basically recidivism rate as far as being locked up in a juvenile facility and then going to an adult prison eventually in their life, are extremely high. They've been high the entire history of these juvenile prisons or these juvenile facilities. So eventually someone's got to look into that. I thought by now somebody would, but eventually somebody's got to realize that I would say almost 9 out of 10 people that go to a juvenile facility, you're going to look at them and they're going to end up in prison. And there's got to be a connection. There's got to be a reason why going to a juvenile facility where, like I said, I went to a high school. I was a captain of a soccer team. I was like a popular guy. You know, how does somebody that where I'm in high school living a normal life, you know, I'm having fun with my friends. I'm going out on the weekend. And another 15-year-old kid is locked in a cell. You know, he's living a different life. There's got to be an alternative, a way of handling that where these kids don't always go to prison. You know, the juvenile facilities, they're gladiator schools. You know, you're not around men. You're around a bunch of boys. You're around a bunch of boys facing time. You're around a bunch of boys from all negative neighborhoods and different gangs. And it's the way they're treated. I know Wales and I know a couple other juvenile facilities that are in Wisconsin have been written up in the newspaper many times. Actually, 3 years ago, they had to shut down one of them because the guards were actually there, found guilty that the guards were opening up the cell doors and slamming the inmates, you know, the teenage kids' hands in the cell doors. And they ended up breaking somebody's hand and they ended up getting infected really bad and they didn't realize it. So I just think instead of these juvenile facilities, treating them like they're already a prisoner. They treat them like a prisoner. They make them wear state clothes. They lock them in. And the only thing that does to a child is it makes them mad. It makes them bitter and mad. It doesn't do anything else. It doesn't teach them anything. It just makes them mad that they can't speak up. Their voice doesn't matter. They're basically treated as property as a teenage kid, and that's very hard to accept. Most people in the world can't accept that. They're not mature enough at that stage, and they wonder why the minute they get out of prison, the first argument that they get into, they pull out a gun and shoot somebody, or they end up beating them up because they're not even capable of having a cordial conversation or talking about their problems or walking away from the situation because they've never ever done that in their entire life. from growing up, from the projects to getting in fights where you don't walk away and then you go to a youth facility where you don't have family, you don't have your mother, you don't have anything, you have to fight for everything. And I just think if those systems were treated a little bit different and the correctional officers had special training and it was more encouragement, it was more resources in there about going to school, about getting jobs. You know, if you released all these teenage kids with full-time jobs and transportation and maybe a program to check into where they're going to a program every single week, every single couple of days around other people that do want to change their life and maybe around mentors. Because I think the biggest thing that these kids are missing when I used to hear about their prison stories and even grown men, the most common thing that they're missing is a male role model, a good male role model in life. That's all they're missing. Most of these hardened criminals that they're called, that's the only thing they're missing. If you put a male role model in their life that was somebody that they could look up to, somebody they respected, and somebody they would also listen to, I really think it would change the whole world. But instead of these kids go to a juvenile facility, they're treated like crap, they're thrown in a cell, they're belittled, and they're treated like mini prisons, and that does nothing. So I think, number one, we need to look into the youth facilities, because I think if we started changing the recidivism rate as a youth, I think it would go a big difference. And then eventually over time, we would meet these kids that went to these youth prisons that didn't go to prison, and then that could come back to them and could talk to these youth. And we could involve a lot of things, a lot of schools. And there's got to be money in that as well as the government. There's got to be some type of, you know, because you don't file taxes if you hire somebody in prison, and there's a lot of benefits from hiring somebody that was incarcerated or is currently incarcerated. So there's got to be some type of programs that the government, where it's still beneficial to them to have these jobs and things like that. And that's what I mean with the second thing. I've always thought about when I was in minimum security prison, they had these contracts with jobs where you would go there and they would be all minimum wage jobs, or they would be lower than minimum wage, and you would work there. But when you got out of prison, most of these, you know, prisons you're at, they're hours away from your house, or they're up north, or they're in the country, and they're away from the cities or the where most people live. So it's nice that you have a job when you're in minimum security prison, but when you get out, most of these jobs aren't retained by these people because they have to move back home, and it's an hour ride or it's a 2-hour ride to their job. I just think if there were companies that were set up where, you know, like welding or trade schools, and or like trades that you could work, electricians and things like that, where they would have contracts when you got out of prison from where you're, you know, close to where you're from. And I think it would be beneficial for everybody. You're making a decent wage, you have a job, and right there you're surrounded with people that clearly, you know, want to do something different. You know, you're not surrounded with people that just got out and are back in the hood and are trying to, you know, flip some weight real quick. You're around people that got out and chose to go to work. And I think that's the biggest thing, you know, not overthinking it. You know, these people from prison don't need a list of 100 things. You know, they make it on nothing. You know, they're very intelligent in there, surprisingly. Even I could say that, because when I went to prison, I didn't think that there was so much intelligence in there. But when you're giving these guys, you know, 10 years, and they do nothing but read books and stay motivated and want to go home, you don't have to come out and give them a whole list of things. You just have to come out, and I think if there are just jobs, schools, and resources as far as surrounding them with people that have been or can compare to their past and that is doing good. I think if you did those three things to most people that got out of prison, if they had a little support system instantly where it was meetings they went to every couple of days, and they would get picked up if they couldn't drive there, and they just had people that were just like, listen, we know what you've been through. We've been out for years, or I'm a business owner now, or I'm a lawyer now, or I'm a teacher, or I have a master's degree, I've heard. And you just start surrounding themselves with people that give them hope, because that's the one thing where there's not a lot of in prison. You know, in California, that's one thing I said, you know, you're given hope every day. You wake up, there's sun, there's palm trees, and there's opportunity. You're given hope. But in prison, there's no hope. You start looking around and you see nothing but negativity. You see nothing but violence, and you see nothing but hatred and bitterness and just negativity all day. And it gets to a person where I just think if they were surrounded with people that showed them hope, you know, when I got out, it was, I tried to Google people right away. Even when I was in prison, I tried to ask, like, you know, all the big time leaders and the guys that's been in 20 years. I was like, you know, who do you look up to? You know, who's the one guy that came in here that, you know, walked through the same shit we're walking through and the same stuff we're walking through and seen the same things that came out that actually made it? And there weren't many people that could say anything. They were like, well, you know, there's really not that person. There's not that hero. There's not that one figure that walked this every single day, that made it before they were famous and made it before they had the resources, that survived in here and made it in prison. There really isn't that many people in life out of the hundreds and thousands of people that go to prison. We're starting to realize, you know, there's really not anybody who's made it that far. So I just think that there should be hope. And if you get a team together, which, you know, like you said, I'm working on slowly by telling my story and staying the path that I have designed for myself and my team, I'll eventually meet people. But I just think you got to give these resources and surround them with different. Most of my friends are from the projects, are from, you know, I'm from Wisconsin, but most of them are from the hood in Milwaukee, or they're from the projects from Chicago. And those are really rough neighborhoods. They're primarily African American, and they don't know anything. And most of them have to go back to these projects, and it's just like, that's a very daunting task, you know, to go back to the projects, to find a job, to do all this stuff. It sounds real easy to say, to tell somebody, hey, come out and just go get a job and just, you know, not feel awkward or anything. Because in prison, most of these guys, they feel like they're somebody. In prison, you have a reputation. On every unit you're on, people know who you are. No matter if you're the highest guy in the unit, the leader of the unit, or, you know, somebody has power, or somebody that is just a nobody, everybody knows that. You have your place. And I just feel like when you come out of prison, you're just a nobody, and it can be a good thing. But you also lose your sense. You know, you go from being this figure where you're motivated and you're somebody, you're respected, to coming out and knowing nothing and having nobody's respect. And, you know, now you feel like you're a second class citizen going for these jobs when you don't have a great resume compared to everybody. You're always getting overlooked. You have your PO showing up at your job. You're just constantly reminded that you're a second class, you know, human being. And that just gets tiring. So it would be nice that the minute you get released, to be surrounded with people that were second class human beings, but that are now doing something, showing you hope, like, hey man, there's a way, there's a different way, there's a legal way, there's a smarter way. And most of it just takes hard work and dedication. And that's something that prison instills in these guys. So most of them are willing to work towards their opportunity. So like I said, that's always been a dream of mine, to have these facilities set up where, you know, maybe like welding or electrician or jobs where they pay decent, and you could still pay them a little less than the average, but a wage where they could still get by. The company makes money. You know, when you file taxes and you hire anybody that's been previously incarcerated, that definitely works towards businesses' taxes. It's beneficial for them for sure. So, you know, it's positivity all the way around. And then you start implementing programs where, you know, you get schools involved. And in California, my school tried to go to a maximum security prison to try to recruit people to come to, you know, their school. Well, when they got out, and there was actually 100 schools on the waiting list. You know, we were number 101, and that's mind blowing to me, because in Wisconsin, I've never seen anybody come inside those bars from outside resources. You know, we don't even have one school, you know, wanting to go to the prison system, let alone on one school on the waiting list. So that's just what I mean about different states. And, you know, you got to think about states like Wyoming. You know, a black guy in Wyoming getting out of prison for 5 years, driving his Cadillac downtown or on the road at 9 o'clock at night is a little different than, you know, somebody in LA driving a Cadillac at 9 at night. You know, you kind of fit in a little more. So the states are so different apart. And I just think if we kind of had a universal system where we implemented just jobs, schooling, and people that have been around the same thing, that are doing something good with their lives, I think the recidivism rate would change or drop extremely lower.
You know, Tom, this was just, it was an article which was written in January, just a few months ago. There's a probation officer, her name is Stephanie James, and she wrote, she's from the San Joaquin County, she's a chief probation officer. And she said that we now know today from a growing body of brain science research is that the brain is not fully developed until the age of 25. Teenagers, mm-hmm. whether they are 16 or 19, have trouble with impulse control and poor decision-making skills. This is a probation officer whom I would recommend that you get in contact with, and you can have her go on the internet and type in your interview to hear what you're saying, and maybe you can be of help with her in maybe making some adjustments or trying to come up with solutions. Also, there's a state senator from California. She's a Democrat. Her name is Nancy Skinner, and she is also working on the state juvenile justice system by proposing putting these proposals together to raise the age limit of these juveniles to maybe from 17 to 19 or 20 or 21. I think that you would be very good in contacting them, and I would be willing to talk with them as well if they needed to know any more. But I would contact them, and I would definitely let them know about your situation when you were 19 and how your dreams went down and how you're now pursuing them again. But I think they would probably really, really love to hear from you and maybe have you working with them in some way. I think it would be perfect. This article is the California's plan to raise the age of its youth just to the legislative. And I think myself that you would be a benefit to them, and if you can, contact them. They are in California.
Yeah, I would love to contact them. I still remember at my sentencing day that was one thing that stuck out to me about a male's brain doesn't develop fully until 25. So I remember that being part of my defense for my lawyer. And it was just my case is very unique because I was facing so many years in prison. I was facing more years than really anybody that was in my county for a very long time with the age limit that I was, being a first-time offender. And we had everything, you know, we had the state PSI, and that's an investigation unit that kind of goes through your life with a fine-tooth comb. And it was just a very unique case, and the DA offered me 10 years, you know, in when I bailed out. And, you know, after bail, after hearing my story, and really looking into my life, the DA only asked for 1 year in prison, and he was actually worried I was going to walk on probation. I met with him a couple weeks before sentencing, and he was really worried. He was like, listen, man, I think you have a very unique case. I don't know if you're going to go to prison because, you know, you show you're not a bad person. But he was like, I won't ask for anything if you just do a year. He's like, just do a year, you'll go down to a minimum. He went from a hardened DA that was trying to send me away for, you know, 10 years, 15 years if I didn't take the 10. So he was trying to send me away for life. That would have been life for me, life-changing for sure. So he went down to a year. The state PSI only asked for 1 to 2 years max, and, you know, she doubled it. I took the blame of the crime, but I totally agree. You know, I was 18 when I committed these crimes, 19 when I was sentenced. And it's not a excuse to say, no, I'm not 25. My brain, it's a fact. You know, I'm not a doctor. I'm not a psychologist or anything like this. You know, it's a fact. And I think that needs to be taken in consideration. And same thing with these kids that go to juvenile facility. You know, most people, at least I did, and most people that are privileged or more wealthy, they just can't understand the concept of going to a juvenile facility and not learning your lesson or not understanding that this isn't right and then coming out and then committing a crime. You know, the first thing you hear from the DA and from the judge is, weren't you, because before I got sentenced, I used to go to all these sentencings to all these teenage kids, or I would go to Milwaukee to gun charges and, you know, things close to my case to see how sentencing was. I was terrified. So I would just sit in to all these sentencings to kind of see how it went. And that's the first thing, you know, the first two things that I noticed in the court system on almost every single case is when you apologize, you really don't mean it. And you're just apologizing to get your sentence lower. And when you don't apologize, you're the worst person in the world. So the apology was really weird for me because I sat in on over 20 sentencings, and I noticed that every judge said it didn't matter if they apologized or they didn't. They got slammed for it. So it was a no-win in the apology. And then they also got slammed for having a previous record. Every single time it was, you know, why didn't you learn your lesson, or why didn't you not repeat the same poor choices and things. And they were a little bit more harder on juvenile kids that didn't live a normal life, that didn't go to a private or a public high school and just lived a normal teenage life where they got to go to school and they just had to worry about school, and they didn't have to fear for their life walking home. They didn't have to fear for their life when they went into their houses and their neighborhoods, and they didn't get an opportunity to live a fair life, and they didn't have a fair chance, and they had to grow up inside of a cell and inside of, you know, around other teenage kids that have no hope, that are lost causes, which some of them are. That's just the way the world goes, unfortunately. Some of these kids are brought up and they're just a lost cause. They have too much hatred. They have too much animosity. And, you know, you'll see that with their actions. But, you know, you're taking kids that do have potential, that they have value in life. They can bring something. They're very artistic, or they're very intelligent. They're very motivated. They have some type of quality that's better than most kids, that they're able to survive in a youth facility and then come out. But the judges and the DA don't see that. They just see, oh, you know, you got sentenced already one time, but you're continuing to make the same poor choices. And it's like most of these poor choices are, like you said, impulse. Their impulse in a situation that it's a very high emotional situation, it's very intense. And, you know, most people at the end of the day from these environments, they're going to act one way and one way only, whether they want to do that or they don't. Most people don't want to act violent, and they just have to. They fear for their life. And at the end of the day, when you're in the ghetto or you're in a project and it's one person versus another, or it's a group versus another, you have to win, because, you know, if you lose, you're not talking about getting sentenced. You're talking about, you know, your mom showing up at a funeral. So it's just mind blowing that they're harder on people that's been in a system where by now it's 2020, maybe in 1980 or maybe in 1985, you could say that, but now it's starting to be history. You know, and now we're 20, 30 years into these youth facilities that started coming around, where we're starting to notice that the recidivism rate is in the 90s, is in the high 80%. And at the end of the day, you can say whatever you want about these kids, but at the end of the day, you have to say something about the system as well. It's not just the thousands of kids that come in, it's all bad luck. No, it's something to deal with the system of how they are treating these kids, where they just can't. They come out and they can't react in a mature way, and they've never been given an opportunity to do that. They've never been shown a way to do that. Even in these programs in prison, I had to take anger management. It was a joke. The anger management was a joke. The instructor would just belittle you. They would call you names. They would lock you in the cell, and they would just force you to get so angry. And then if you didn't blow up and you just sat there and accepted it, they would say, oh, okay, he learned his lesson. He might not have a bad anger problem. And then they would help you. But it was a joke. So I just think that that we need to target the youth, and we need to target people getting out, because at the end of the day, talking about changing the system and making all the changes we need, that's going to happen over time, but that's a very large change, and I just don't think people realize how large of a change that's going to be. So the few quick changes, or the few things we can really work on, are, you know, the youth facilities, working with the youth, getting a second opportunity, you know, to hopefully give these kids a fair opportunity to show who they are and what they're capable of and what they can bring to the world. And as well as getting out of prison, it's a huge task of getting out of prison. And like I said, when you're in prison, the only thing you think of every day, even though you do your day and you kind of zone the world out, you think about that release date. You know, it's what motivates 95% of people, is coming home, just coming home. When that release date is, it's always in the back of your mind. It's ingrained in the back of your mind. And I just think it's, you know, when you're in prison, you're just focused on that day. And then that day comes, and then you're not focused on the next day after that. You're not focused on the next month after that, because you don't really know how to prepare. You don't know how to fill out job applications. You don't know how to, how can you ask a guy that spent 4 or 5 years in a prison cell in a maximum medium security prison, seeing the things he did, to come out and then talk to an employer right away and not have that employer instantly realize, well, this dude's from the ghetto or this dude's from prison. I mean, it's very hard to change your mannerisms in 24 hours to get a job, even a week to live basically in a different planet, in a jungle. and come out and sit in a job interview. You know, that's a very daunting task, and there's just nobody to help these people, you know, how to sit in a job interview. You know, in my minimum security prison, that we actually had to fill out job applications, and there were over 60 people, and this was an adult prison, so all of us were, you know, in our, you know, young 20s to mid-20s, the youngest people were. They didn't know how to fill out a job application. Didn't even know how to fill it out correctly, at least. And it's like, you know, you already have, out of the 100% of population, everybody that gets out of prison, you can instantly cut off 50% of them, of people reoffending. And that's just that's a general number. That's kind of being generous. But within the first, like, you know, 5 years, you can cut off 50% of people. And then out of those 50% of people, you know, how many people are going to school and getting degrees and getting careers? You know, you can cut off another 20%. You can cut off another little percentage that are addicts. You can cut off another little percentage that die. And you start getting down to a very small percentage just from people that get out of just basic surviving, just getting a job, going to school, furthering education, or pursuing something. You're just instantly talking about a little percentage. So I just think that if there were, like, you came out and then you were instantly put in with people that were like, oh, here's how you do jobs, here's a job, here's a job that would fit, you know, what you're looking for, what you want to pursue in the future. You know, they have Homeboy Industries out here in California, which is really, really awesome. It's a really awesome organization. You know, they should have something like that in every state. You know, they should have just something where the prison population can go and they can get an opportunity. Nothing is given to them, but they're given an opportunity, how the world works. And like I said, I think if everybody walked out of prison with a job, a full-time job, or no matter what, if they didn't have a house, they could have nothing. They could walk out with the clothes on their back. But if you give them a job where they have enough income to survive on their own, and you provide them with resources of where they're able to talk to people about what's going on, they're able to relate to people that are doing something positive with their life, but at one point those people were at where they're at, those two things with role models and stuff, those just very few things, I think you would see the recidivism rate completely drop. The people don't want to go back.
I'm glad you say that, because I'll tell you, we have in the government, in the United States, there are so many in government that they don't have a clue about all these different cultures you're talking about, and that's the problem. Now, again, when I was a social worker years ago for an agency, a lot of these social workers, when they come out of college, are from prominent backgrounds. They're not married. They have no children. They have no husband. No, you know, they have never been in the situation of the dysfunctional families that they're working with. So when they go into these homes, they're expecting miracles from these families right away. And in response, these families get very upset because this worker they're not relating to, and the worker's not relating to them. So there's going to be some resistance there. Before you know it, the children are going to be removed from the home under a care and protection and placed in foster homes, which not all foster homes are accurate either. You find social workers that have been through some of those situations and have overcome are the best social workers. You find in substance abuse counseling, those who have been addicted in the past and overcame make the best counselors, substance abuse counselors. Your situation, you've been at both ends, just like a lot of us. We've seen both sides. We've been in both sides. So we can relate to either side. In your situation, you came from a average home. You came from doing all kinds of productive things, and then you fell because of a toxic relationship. You saw what it was inside the prison. You got involved, or you were able to observe all the different cultures and all the different issues. This is why I say that you would be good to work with politicians in California and maybe beyond, to work with probation officers like this one that's interested in the juvenile situations and understands them. Those are the ones that you would be perfect to work with, because you could help them a lot to make some really productive decisions and some positive decisions to, like you say, to decrease the recidivism rate and at the same time to help these youth. Another thing is, if you ever did start an organization, there are people who are experienced in working with people that don't know how to fill out applications or even do their resumes. I used to help years ago. I used to help prisoners that were coming out with putting together resumes. But there were so many people that could voluntarily provide their services to helping these youth to do their resumes. There were people that could work with you on other issues. These are some of the things that I think you would be perfect at working with these politicians on. It's something that you should consider, really, Tom, because I think you would be perfect for this.
I'm considering a lot, and I would definitely love to help out in any way I can, because it's crazy. It was very humbling when I first went to prison because I would, like you said, I hung out with the younger crowd right away, and most of them were in their first-degree reckless endangerment or armed robberies with a real gun and things like that. And I'm not from the hood, and I had a lot of friends growing up in the hood, but I'm not from the hood or projects, Gary, Indiana, and Chi-Town, and some of these projects where they're like, they're just rough. And you start hearing their stories, and in the beginning it was like, you know, I was a superstar. I was, like you said, I was very productive when I was in the world, and then I fell. I fell for 2 weeks. It was the lowest 2 weeks of my life, and then I was in jail for the first time, facing, you know, over 100 years in prison. So it was hard to understand, but when I would tell my story, there was nobody else like me. There's nobody else that went to high school and had a regular high school and had a average house and had a, you know, had a car when I was 16 and certain things like that. And you would hear these stories from growing up in the projects, and I would be mind blown because I would feel so bad because I was like, damn, if they were actually giving my life just an opportunity, basically, this kid would have been a millionaire. This kid would have succeeded. Like, it's crazy. He's only got 10 years of prison after what he's been through, you know, after hearing about, you know, their brother dying in their arms and the fear they have every day with the police and how their schools were set up and how walking home was and basically just living in fear and having, you know, no father figure at all or not a good one, no, and the mother doing the best she can, but working three jobs or a drug addict or a prostitution. And you hear about what these children just grow up in these houses filled with, like, people and just the abuse and the negativity and the trauma that they grow up into. And it's like, damn, you know, you kind of made it by just doing, you know, one armed robbery in your life and learning your lesson, where, you know, compared to me, it was like, you know, I was given everything and I threw it away. So it's that's the only reason I was so fascinated with, you know, getting involved in people from, you know, these projects. I loved hearing their stories, and I loved, you know, because I thought about it like, damn, if this person can make it, anybody in the world can make it.
Yeah, and some of these cases, too, with these young, these people of color, they're not, a lot of them, like you say, were brought up in homes that were, there was so much abuse, whether it be sexual or physical or whatever. And then they go out in the streets and they're being all over again, being abused by police officers, you know, law enforcement or others that are carrying that hatred, you know, because of the pigmentation. But these are situations that these young people are full of anger and frustration, and there's no role models anymore. And you mentioned the churches, and I'm sorry to agree with you, but there's a lot of these pastors, and I remember hearing a pastor one time right here in Massachusetts, in Boston, calling these kids hoodlums. And to me, if the churches were more involved, if these pastors were more involved in helping, maybe these so-called hoodlums would not be hoodlums. I'm going to say real quickly, too, Tom, we're going to be running out of time. And next Thursday, same time.
Yes.
But in the meantime, the one that wrote the article on the California's plan to raise the age, mentioning the politician, the editor's name is Jeremy Laudenbach. He's a senior editor of the Chronicle of Social Change. And again, if you can contact him, and also if you can contact the Senator Nancy Skinner and also that probation officer and maybe try to work something out with them.
I will. I appreciate you having me. I will be on here next Thursday to continue to talk to you.
I think that you're going to make a big change, and maybe sometimes people don't understand, but this may be God's way of using you in a big way, and I really appreciate, again, having you on with us.
Thank you so much, and we'll be in talk soon.
Any last-minute comments before we close?
Just don't give up faith. You know, faith is to believe in the unseen. You can't really see it, but it's a daunting task, and trust me, it doesn't come without speed bumps, but I just firmly believe if you can make it in a cell with no resources, you can come out here, and it's extremely hard, but, you know, you can make it, and, you know, you got to throw the pride aside and be willing to ask for help.
Thank you so, so much, Thomas. And we will talk with you next Thursday. I really appreciate you being on with us, and you are a blessing to a lot of people. Thank you so much for being with us.
All right. Thank you. Have a good day. Bye.
You too. Bye-bye.